Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Ohio Governor Mike DeWine said in an interview yesterday that he was worried the surge of coronavirus cases means his state, quote, could become Florida. Buddy, you wish, said a coked-up alligator on a jet ski.
Recorded from locations that are not 30 Rockefeller Plaza, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth chats with Saturday Night Live's Colin Jost, whose new memoir, A Very Punchable Face, is available now. But first, a closer look.
President Trump gave a truly terrifying interview in which he made clear he does not care about the pandemic that's raging out of control as he sends secret police to an American city to snatch protesters off the streets. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. The country's in the midst of a spiraling pandemic that has killed 140,000 Americans and left tens of millions unemployed, and yet the president has, according to Republican officials, people close to him and our own eyes and ears decided to just move on from the crisis. An advisor to the Republican governor of Texas, where the outbreak is spreading out of control, told the New York Times over the weekend, the president got bored with it. Oh, I'm sorry, Commodus, were you not entertained? Seriously, you were bored with the pandemic? Bored with the quarantine? I understand. I've watched so much Netflix, the on-screen message changed. But you're bored with the pandemic. That's your job. Would you have preferred if the coronavirus had a swimsuit contest? And even when he can be bothered to talk about the coronavirus outbreak, he can't help but immediately veer into a topic that's more interesting to him, like his TV ratings. Today he announced he'd be bringing back his humiliating press briefing slash therapy sessions, not because there's an out-of-control pandemic that requires leadership, but because his TV ratings were so good.
Well, we had very successful briefings. I was doing them, and we had a lot of people watching, record numbers watching. In the history of cable television, there's never been anything like it. So I think we'll start that probably starting tomorrow. I'll do it at 5 o'clock like we were doing. We had a good slot. And a lot of people were watching, and that's a good thing.
The ratings were incredible. People are spending a lot more time inside watching TV for some reason.
It sucks so hard that we have a president who says things like, we had a good slot. He's bored by coronavirus, but he loves TV.
We're hoping in the fall they put me on after This Is Us. That would be a hell of a lead-in.
Also, of course, the ratings were good. People are locked inside with nothing to watch, desperate for information about the out-of-control virus you failed to stop. Ratings for Wheel of Fortune would be up, too, if Pat Sajak went on a killing spree and announced his next victims via puzzle. Pat, I'd like to solve your next Dan from Rochester. Of course, Trump doesn't actually care about the deadly virus that's spreading. He wants to resume the briefing so he can do what he always does, whine about how unfairly he's been treated, threaten his political opponents with state violence, fight with reporters and speculate wildly about dumb new treatments until Dr. Fauci covers his entire face.
Fauci, what if you, and again, I'm just blue skying here, ate a battery and took a bath of Pepto-Bismol? Would that Would that cure the virus, Fauci? Fauci, why are you wearing so many masks?
So Trump is bored with the pandemic, and you can tell he's bored from what he's been choosing to focus on instead, beans and trucks.
On a day when 941 people died of the coronavirus in this country, this is what is front of mind for the president, beans. The president giving an endorsement to Goya a day after his daughter, Ivanka Trump, did the same, weighing into this bizarre culture war after Goya's CEO was criticized on social media for effusively praising the president.
During an official event at the White House, it became a photo op for the president. Looking to move past the pandemic and look toward the November election, the president claiming the biggest threat to this country is his rival, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. The event turned into a campaign-style rally. The president had pickup trucks and giant weights symbolizing government regulation. The president only mentioning the coronavirus once.
On the same day the U.S. set another daily record with 75,000 new cases, the president was playing with trucks on the White House lawn like he was lured into one of those Chevy commercials.
J.D. Power, isn't he part of the deep state?
This looks like one of those summer replacement game shows where if you get an answer wrong, Ellen DeGeneres drops a truck on you. At what point can we consider an obsession with trucks a disqualifying attribute for a president? I mean, adults are allowed to have whatever hobbies they want, but if Bill Clinton had shown up to every press conference with a Tamagotchi, Republicans definitely would have impeached him a second time. Now, if you excuse me, I gotta go feed this little fella. I mean, having a president obsessed with trucks is like having a president obsessed with trains. Amid a national health crisis and record unemployment, the federal government, led by a bored and sadistic president, has abandoned us. They simply do not care about the 140,000 Americans who have died, the tens of millions who have lost jobs, the 5 million who have lost health insurance, or the 23 million who face eviction in the coming months. This is the result of decades of conservative governance that has raided the Treasury to dole out billions in defense spending and tax cuts for the wealthy while hollowing out everything else. Now we have a pudding-brained infomercial salesman who's more interested in what happens to a dead Confederate general than a living middle school teacher trying to convince us that statues and graffiti are more important than a pandemic that's caused massive suffering. And even when he was asked point blank about the record number of new cases by Fox's Chris Wallace this weekend, Trump basically shrugged.
I'm gonna do you a favor, because I'm sure a lot of people listening right now are gonna say, Trump, he tries to play it down. He tries to make it not seem as serious as it is.
No, this is very serious.
75,000 cases a day.
Show me the death chart.
Well, I don't have the death chart.
Well, the death chart is much more important.
But I can tell you, the death chart is 1,000 cases a day.
Excuse me. It's all too much. It shouldn't be one case. It came from China. They should have never let it escape. They should have never let it out. But it is what it is.
It is what it is a fine thing to hear. From a drinking buddy, as he promises you that in time, you will forget about Denise. But when it is a pandemic and the guy saying it is the president, that's a problem. Had FDR responded to Pearl Harbor with a happens t-shirt, we'd probably feel different about him today. We certainly wouldn't honor him with the finest strip of road along the East River that's ever existed. Also, I love that Wallace started out by saying, I'm gonna do you a favor, and then Trump immediately interrupts him. That's how bad a strategist he is. If someone says, I'm gonna do you a favor, you freeze like a squirrel in a park until you find out the favor. You don't start an argument. Second, it's not reassuring. When presented with evidence of a rapidly spreading disease, your answer is, show me the death chart. You know, because that implies there are enough deaths for a chart. In fact, if you work in any office setting and you have death charts lying around, something isn't right. Hey, Brad, regional sales are looking really good this quarter. That's fantastic, Linda. Hey, would you hand me the death chart? You know, the big one that folds out? In fact, if this interview revealed anything, it's that the president is far less concerned with the deadly virus sweeping through this nation than he is with proving that he supposedly did well on a test designed to detect cognitive defects that he constantly brags about. Except this time he was challenged by the host, Chris Wallace, in a way he obviously was not expecting.
Let's take a test. Let's take a test right now. Let's go down. Joe and I will take a test. Let him take the same test that I took.
Incidentally, I took the test, too, when I heard that you passed it.
Yeah, how did
it's
you
not
do
the hard, well, it's not the hardest test.
No, but
it
the last...
It has a picture, and it says, what's that? And it's an elephant.
No. You see, that's all misrepresentation.
Well, that's what it was on the web.
It's all misrepresentation. Because, yes, the first few questions are easy, but I'll bet you couldn't even answer the last five questions. I'll bet you couldn't. They get very hard, the last five
questions. Well, one of them was count back from 100 by 7.
And let me tell you, You couldn't answer. You couldn't answer.
All right, what's the question?
Many of the questions. I'd get you the test. I'd like to give it.
Here's a question that should be on Trump's next cognitive test. Name one question from your last cognitive test. If you're going to constantly brag about how well you did, you should at least be able to cite one of the questions. If you come home and tell your parents you aced your driving test and they asked you what you did, you can't just shrug and say, car stuff, because then they're going to know you skipped it and had your buddy print out a fake ID. Also, I don't know what's more alarming, that Trump even had to take this test in the first place, or how proud he is with how he did. It's possible this is the first test he ever passed that he took himself. He probably paid an MIT student to come with him, but then when he saw how easy it was, sent him home.
Elephant? Well, I know what that is. Get out of here, Poindexter. I'm not paying you, Poindexter. The deal was if you took the test. Good news, I wasn't going to pay you anyway. Don't be sad, Poindexter.
I genuinely can't believe this is a real exchange that happened at the White House. If you read this transcript without any names attached, you think they were doctor's notes from a psych ward. Also, there's no way Trump can count backwards from 100 by sevens. The money I would pay to see him try that.
100, and then you're into the 90s. Some people say 95. Some people say 92. I had a guy come up to me the other day. Big guy. Tough guy. Tears in his eyes. And he said, sir, I think it's 91. And I said, Obama, he wouldn't let you say that, but I will. I will.
The only cognitive test we've ever needed for Trump is a camera and a microphone, and he's failed it 100 times. We know this. We've also known since long before he was president that he admires and seeks to emulate tyrants and despots. The guy doesn't know how many articles there are in the Constitution, but he's repeatedly bragged about his good relationships with authoritarian leaders and defended some of the most horrific human rights abuses in history. Like, for example, the Tiananmen Square massacre.
Mr. Trump, some of your Republican critics have expressed concern about comments you have made praising authoritarian dictators. You have said positive things about Putin as a leader and about China's massacre of pro-democracy protesters at Tiananmen Square. You said, quote, when the students poured into Tiananmen Square, the Chinese government almost blew it. Then they were vicious, they were horrible, but they put it down with strength. That shows you the power of strength. How do you respond
to that? Doesn't mean I was endorsing that. I was not endorsing it. I said that is a strong, powerful government that put it down with strength, and then they kept down the riot. It was a horrible thing. It doesn't mean at all I was endorsing it.
Yes, you were. Trump refuses to be pinned down about anything. One day, he'll say you're his best friend. The next, he'll pretend he's never met you. When he named his eldest son after himself, he probably wrote on the birth certificate, this is not an endorsement. The Tiananmen Square protests were peaceful demonstrations led by students calling for democratic reforms. But Trump sees any peaceful challenge to the status quo as a riot instigated by terrorists, which is how despots talk. And today he issued a chilling threat to send more federal officers to American cities after lying about the protests in Portland on Sunday.
More federal law enforcement, that I can tell you. In Portland, they've done a fantastic job. You know, if you look at what's gone on in Portland, those are anarchists, and we've taken a very tough stand. If we didn't take a stand in Portland, you know, we've arrested many of these leaders. If we didn't take that stand, right now you would have a problem like, you know, they were going to lose Portland.
What the hell are you talking about? They were going to lose Portland? To who? Oh, okay. Huh. They were playing the long game, huh? People in Portland are anything but anarchists. Restaurants in Portland have more rules than a Manhattan co-op board. If you don't put your banana peel in the compost bin, they'll drive you to the city limits in a solar-powered car and leave you there. This guy is so detached from reality. Everything in his yogurt brain is a Steven Seagal movie.
Portland is under siege, so I had to go above the law, make an executive decision to send an attack force out for justice.
What we're seeing in cities across the country are peaceful protests against police brutality and systemic racism demanding change to an unjust and oppressive system. But Trump is only capable of emulating the authoritarian despots he admires, which is exactly what he's doing in Portland.
There are secret police operating on the streets of an American city under the direction of the president. And in the past week, they have been recorded snatching a protester off the street and forcing him into an unmarked car and shooting another peaceful protester with a non-lethal round in the head. These agents have been driving unmarked vehicles and tear-gassing protesters while refusing to identify themselves.
Oregon Public Broadcasting chased the story down, reporting, quote, federal law enforcement officers have been using unmarked vehicles to drive around downtown Portland and detain protesters since at least Tuesday. Personal accounts and multiple videos posted online show the officers driving up to people detaining individuals with no explanation about why they're being arrested and driving off.
Trump is using these federal forces as a personal paramilitary force. That is what dictators do. That is not what presidents of a democratic republic do.
Oh, good. A mentally incontinent man-toddler has his own personal paramilitary force. In addition to kidnapping protesters and stuffing them into unmarked vans, he's probably got them in the White House kitchen trying to open a can of Goya beans.
I've never opened a can before. I tried to eat the last one, but it got lodged in my esophagus.
So much of our democratic system relies on norms, and Trump freely just shatters all of them. For example, as Joe Biden opened up a 15-point lead in new polls, Trump said on Sunday he would not necessarily accept the outcome of the election as legitimate because mail-in balloting, a thing Americans, including Trump himself, have been doing for a century and a half, might somehow rig the election.
I think mail-in voting is going to rig the election. I really do.
Are you suggesting that you might not accept the results of the election?
I have to see. Look. Hillary Clinton asked me the same thing.
Can you give a direct answer? You will accept the election?
I have to see. Look, I have to see. No, I'm not going to just say yes. I'm not going to say no. And I didn't last time either.
Oh, you're going to keep us in suspense? You're talking about a presidential election and the peaceful transfer of power. One of the hallmarks of our democracy, like it's the season finale of Dallas. Except there's not much suspense when you walk around with a huge gun talking about how much you hate JR.
Fresh Dallas ref.
Cool it.
Okay.
Second, you and your aides, including your press secretary and vice president, have all voted by mail, which Americans have been doing in this country since the Civil War, which I know is sensitive for you since you rooted for the side that lost. So this is where we're at. A president who dispatches secret police to round up dissidents and refuses to accept the outcome of a democratic election. We've certainly had national crises and horrible presidents before, but when historians look back at this moment, I'm certain they'll say,
there's never been anything like it.
This has been A Closer Look.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Our guest tonight is one of the head writers at Saturday Night Live and co-anchor on Weekend Update. His memoir, A Very Punchable Face, is available now. Here's my conversation with our good friend, Colin Jost.
Hey, Colin, how are you, buddy?
Good. How are you, Seth?
Good. So, you are in Montauk right now. This is the house that you filmed your three Weekend Update, your quarantine editions of Weekend Update, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Obviously, we both have friends who are very kind with their gifts. You sent me a photo of what your co-anchor, Michael Chase, sent you for your birthday.
Yeah, it was really a photo I could only send to fellow comedy writers. Michael Chase sent me a box on my birthday, and the card that came with the box said, "Dress for the job you want." And then I opened the box, and it was a police uniform, a police officer's uniform with a Republican National Convention badge on it. And I opened it, and I was like, I laughed so hard for like 2 minutes straight, and then had no idea what to do with it. And my friends were like, you should take one, might as well just take one picture in it. I was like, that is the worst advice. Like, oh yeah, what could go wrong with one picture of you in it?
What I love the most about it is a good amount of thought and care had to go into it.
Oh my God, in the middle of a quarantine to track down an official police uniform and get it in the mail to be delivered by someone's birthday when other people can't get like toilet paper.
Colin, Che is a huge friend of you. He is a great supporter of you. You are the person who found him for SNL. So you guys are really close. And yet he actively tries to cancel you on social media This is a photo that he posted on Instagram we have. So this is, you guys are hanging out together having a nice time.
Yes. He came to visit me. It was very nice. We got to catch up and hang out. We were driving around and he, of course, noticed that the local drugstore is named White's. And so he had me loop around in front of it again and then take a photo of the two of us. I was smiling in the photo. He is grimacing. And then he wrote that I made him wait in the car so I could go into the drugstore to buy tiki torches. So I could go into White's drugstore to buy tiki torches. And then the first comment on the video is someone saying, I don't understand. Aren't you guys friends or not? Why would he do this? And Shay immediately responds, we are not friends. I think that's obvious. And then every post, even if it's unrelated to me, he's just been putting hashtag cancel Jost.
And you are currently on a press tour for your new book. And this is a time that I assume you have a publicist working with you to help you manage the press. What does your publicist feel about how your friend is lending a helping hand?
I would probably say trepidation, deep anxiety, confusion.
I, as a friend to you, I was very happy. And again, I think this is anyone's goal in life, is that your friends will write a memoir and you will end up in it. Yep. And there are multiple stories about a trip that my brother, Andy Samberg, and you took to Scandinavia back in 07. And I'm very glad that you, I think a lot of people, if this happened to them, they would maybe leave it out of their memoir. But you are very honest in this book, and you do admit to the fact that you fell asleep in a graveyard in Helsinki, Finland.
That's correct. I come forward. I come clean on that. my favorite detail about it is you know how bad I am both with managing time and understanding the concept of time. And I remember I fell asleep in what I took a nap on the way home, walking home through Helsinki, Finland, alone at 3 a.m. I got tired and I was like, I better take a power nap halfway through this city I've never been in at night. And I went into what I thought was a park. And went to, so of course, a great place for a nap at 3 a.m. Went into a park, fell asleep, and then woke up what I thought was hours later and saw that I was surrounded by tombstones and that the park was actually not a park and more of a active cemetery. And and then when I finally came back and found you at the hotel and woke you up, I was like, oh my God, Seth, I've been asleep in a graveyard for hours. I must have been in there, if not hours, maybe days even. And you were like, Colin, it's been 45 minutes. We saw you 45 minutes ago at a bar. There's no way it was hours. And that is my sense of time. And then your brother, very lovingly, we were sharing a room. He very lovingly saw I was in a bad way, took all the pillows from his bed, sheets from his own bed, made me a beautiful makeshift bed next to his own bed for me to sleep on and rest. And I, after he put all that work in, I fell asleep directly next to it, not touching any of the blanket or pillows that he had set up lovingly, and fell asleep on a hard Helsinki wood floor for the night.
And I know people are thinking, oh, you guys are a little old for this, but this was a long time ago. And when this happened, I was in my mid-30s.
We'll be right back with more Colin Jost.
One of my favorite things about the book is, and your tenure now at SNL has been so long, and I had a great time writing with you over the years, and I'm such a fan of your writing, and you talk about a lot of your favorite sketches. You have created some real indelible characters. Drunk Uncle, one of my all-time favorites. And you, I should note, you created two with Bobby Moynihan, the other being Anthony Crispino, Secondhand News.
Secondhand News, yeah.
Did you come up with Drunk Uncle first, or did you see Bobby and think that he would be good at being a drunk uncle? Because he's obviously perfect at it.
He's like a deep... It's one of the best acting performances you'll see on our show because it's live and he's finding all these different registers so quickly and all these different emotions. I come up with the concept of secondhand news and I was like, what about secondhand news? And then he had the voice. He just had the like, yeah, I don't know about that, you know, like that kind of, which is a pure performance thing that made gave it a whole other dimension. With Drunk Uncle, he came to me and was like, two words, like Drunk Uncle. I don't know what it is. Is there something? And I was like, I think there's something there. And then figured out like what, you know, what the hell it was. But it was, he was just like, I just thought that was a funny phrase. And the weird thing is when you do that sketch, you know, we, Bobby and I both have uncles. So of course their first question is, now, is this based in on me in some way? Like, I know I kind of go for it on Thanksgiving, but I can hold back most days. And so that's the first question is kind of like, are we okay?
From your uncles, yeah. You also wrote Cecily Strong's The Girl You Wish You Hadn't Started a Conversation With at a Party. I think I said it right. It's maybe the longest character name in the history of SNL.
I think almost no one, even fans of the character, know what the character's called. I think Michael Che said that his mom calls it The Girl Who's Always Wrong.
It's not bad.
It's something like that. And I was like, yeah, that's pretty much, that's maybe better.
That was one of the more, I mean, I think people forget, I think that was the first thing Cecily did on the show. And it's one of the most like bravura performances
I remember in the talk, I write about it in the book, but I remember being with you afterwards, like when you got off stage and you had just done it with her, like out, been out there and just seen the character the first time. And we had a moment afterwards where we were both kind of in awe of her performance. And because you just don't see someone who's brand new at the show hit it, like just not, you know, knock it out of the ballpark in that specific, very fine-tuned way, and the confidence of houses. It was really special.
I think there was a moment where she glanced in her purse at a phone. There was some sort of physical moment that I just thought, who can also do this?
Yeah, it own really, a small was, physical movement in the middle of this big character piece on your first, one of your first shows at SNL, like, and the movie, yeah, you're right. I remember she looked and like put the phone and just with perfect precision and ease.
Yeah. Oh. It was like, oh, they're first. She threw a perfect game her first time on the mound.
It
was
amazing. It really is. I think that's like the right analogy. Like it was like throwing a perfect game your first game.
It is, it's such a fun book. And, but that is one of my favorite things about it is over the years on the show. And again, I don't think a ton of people know this. You've done such a great job of identifying what's really funny about cast members and writing to that voice. And I think it's the most important thing for a writer on that show. And you're just so good at it, buddy.
I learned a lot from you. Like so many people who wrote the show in the time when you were a head writer, you helped me tremendously. And I learned about writing for people from you. And you would write a scene where basically every cast member had a part and it would be their funniest character that they never got on the show in some other way, like Fred's Mets character. I remember one sketch you wrote that was about people brainstorming themes for a prom, and Fred is already like, looks like he's a 45-year-old man with a mustache and a Mets jacket at a high school prom theme meeting, who's just like, what about the Mets? Mets are pretty cool, you know? It was like a throwaway thing you had done in the office and you made it a starring part in this sketch. Yeah. You were great at it.
I think we both would admit to the fact that we have been incredibly lucky in our careers to be surrounded by performers that elevate every word you would ever put on the page.
Yes, and that's what you learn, you learn your own limitations, and then you see someone else that can do these things that you cannot, and you're like, ooh, that's exciting to write for that, write for that person's voice, and get to do things that you can't do yourself.
Well, buddy, obviously nobody knows what the future holds, but I'm looking forward to hopefully the fall and SNL and you at the desk. Congrats on the book, and it's always the best to see you.
Thank you. It is wonderful to see you. I was. We're trying to figure out some elaborate scam when you had an attic door still of who I could hire to be in there and jump out halfway through and scare you. It turns out it's hard to hire street performers who will travel to remote places during a quarantine to scare people.
to violate pandemic rules for the purposes of a laugh.
Yeah, hard to convince wives to let a stranger hide in a crawl space for a day before a show.
Oh, no. My wife loves all your ideas. All of our wives love your ideas the most. All right, I love you, buddy.
I love you. It's great to see you.
A Very Pungible Face, a memoir, is out now.
Late Night with Seth Meyers airs weeknights on NBC at 12:35, 11:35 Central. Original music on the Late Night podcast is by the HE Band. Don't forget to follow the handle Late Night Seth on social media and tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night podcast wherever they get their podcasts.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.